Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The brothers Anderson are. This is Eric, he's the oldest one. The producer who makes it fun, gotta give him the credit. He's good with the edits. He's been the driving force since they begun. Next we got brother Jay. He just the movies that they play. The sip in the middle, Jay is gonna be a little more critical, analytical when he communicates. And lastly we got Drew, the finally family member of this group. He decides if the movie's worth it. Right kind of guy, that's for certain. Three chatty brothers with a family base. Need an excuse to talk away. Dichotomy of personalities. All you really need to do is press play. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies till they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open to that case. We got Eric, Drew, and brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way. Hey.
Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Drew.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 2003 movie Shattered Glass, directed by Billy Ray.
Yeah, we are.
Who also directed Breach. And he wrote the screenplays for Terminator Dark Fate, Captain Phillips, The Hunger Games, and State of Play.
Breach was underrated.
Yeah, I think so. State of Play was underrated.
Yeah. Terminator Dark Fate was probably underrated.
Well, it was rated. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, maybe. What's that? The girl from Terminator Dark Fate is in something else here coming up soon.
She's in a Hulu movie with Kristen Stewart.
Yeah, that apparently is not overrated, I've been told.
Oh, no good?
Well, I what I've heard, I haven't seen it, but I've heard is, A, it makes Kristen Stewart look really, like, emotive compared to that chick who is the other person. And then Aubrey Plaza was great, but, you know, it's but they didn't like the premise. The premise being, on your way to Christmas, you announce that, yeah, you know, to your girlfriend that, yo, remember I said my parents knew I was out? Well, that's not right. I never actually told them. So you're just my friend.
Ouch.
Yeah, that seems like a very, like, 1992 premise.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows? Christmas movies are fun. Anyway, tonight we're going to talk about Shattered Glass 2003. And now this is on your list. You had a craving for this movie.
Yeah, I saw this movie a long time ago. Didn't know anything about the background of the story and was surprised at how good it was, particularly how good the, I guess, kind of the co-lead performance was by Hayden Christensen, who at the time was suffering from the reputation of being rather wooden in the Star Wars prequels.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I actually feel bad for him because of the Star Wars prequels, because the Star Wars prequels didn't derail Natalie Portman's career, and she was
or Ewan McGregor.
Yeah, and she was equally wooden.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. She was extremely wooden. Ewan McGregor was charming, as he always is.
Yeah, because that's what he is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, well. So my history with this movie is that I've listened to the podcast, the Slate podcast, Political Gabfest, for many years. Yeah. And have you heard it?
Nope.
Well, it has three hosts. It's David Plotz, who is formerly, he's the main host. He's formerly of Slate and currently of Atlas Obscura. And he's written a bunch of stuff. And then there's New York Times Magazine writer Emily Bazelon. And then CBS News is John Dickerson. And at one point, they were all working for Slate. And then now I don't think any of them are officially working for Slate except for on the Gabfest. I'm not sure how much they write for Slate anymore. And they're all, like, you know, sort of East Coast, like, elite sort of news, like, liberals. So, you know, it's they have the whatever you think about that is kind of what they are. David Plotz's wife is Hannah Rosen. And Hannah Rosen is the character that Chloe Sevigny's character is based on.
Oh,
like, she never dated Stephen Glass, but, like, Stephen Glass was at their wedding. They had Stephen Glass at their house all the time. They love Stephen Glass. When he tried to get admitted to the California bar, and was denied. They were talking about how, you know, whether people should be forgiven for their past misdeeds. And we'll talk about that, but it's interesting. So, so I was eager to watch the movie with that in mind as well. Because you have to remember, these are actually real people for the most part. I mean, Chloe Sevigny is probably an amalgam or whatever, but based mostly on Hanna Rosin, who was like an advisor to the director in this movie. And she worked for the New Republic with Steven, so.
I would be really interested to track down any interviews of the people portrayed in this movie, because it's such a weird depiction of the, I guess he's the antagonist of the movie, Stephen Glass.
Uh-huh.
But he's so unlikable, but everybody likes him.
That's the criticism they had of the movie, was that what David Plotz said. Actually, there's an interesting article by David Plotz. Maybe it was put out in Slate. I don't know. You can find it on Google's. Maybe I'll put a link to it in the notes, where he talks about how watching the movie, like, you get a good sense of the drama of what was going on at the time, but what mm-hmm. you don't get the sense of is just how charismatic Steven was and how everybody loved Steven. I mean, you know, Steven was full of shit, but he was like everybody's friend full of shit. Like, this makes him much more sinister.
And just kind of smarmy and, like, punchable.
Yeah. Well, that may have been, actually. Turns out, again, Mr. Glass, if you're listening, you can certainly come on the show. We'd be happy to talk to you about this. But, you know, realizing there are real people here, he is maybe still punchable.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm talking specifically about the character in the movie.
Of course. Yes.
But yeah, his whole shtick of, are you mad at me? Am I in trouble?
Yes.
It's just very, like, puerile.
Yeah. Nice word. I think it's a bit of topping from below.
All right.
trying to beta male your way into success instead of alpha male your way into success.
Gotcha. Yeah. That's actually a really good description.
But yeah, and the movie is well acted. And it's got actually actors that I am surprising. I mean, well, we'll get into it. So shall we dive in? Or actually I should, how did you like it watching it now?
I liked it quite a bit. This is a movie that's kind of been rolling around in my head for a while since I saw it the first time. Probably 15 years ago. When did it come out? 2003?
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't see it when it first came out. I think I heard about it a little bit later. So yeah, it's probably been about 15 years. And I forget why, but you mentioned it on, I think, a podcast you were having with Jason a few weeks ago. And that really triggered me, because I, for some reason, I've been thinking about this movie. And that triggered me to want to watch it again and talk about it. And watching it, it's still really good. Peter Skarsgård is so good in this movie.
Oh, he is.
And yeah, it's the setup. I like the narration. I really like the way they unfold the story. And everybody is, you know, except for Hayden Christensen, who actually gets to kind of act, I think, more than he had, certainly in the Star Wars movies. You know, he had more scenery to chew in this movie, definitely. Everybody else is so understated. I mean, even Steve Zahn
is
so understated in this movie that it really balances it out, and it really highlights it's like the weird pathology of the main character, Stephen Glass.
Yeah, the character of Stephen Glass is fascinating. You know, because we all know people that are you know,
just bullshit artists. Yeah, they're everywhere.
And, you know, I certainly went through that phase, you know, when you realize that, until you realize that, you know, it doesn't last. You can't keep it up. Turns out lying is a lot of work. So as a fundamentally lazy person, I prefer to tell the truth these days. But again, one of the things they point out in the opening credits of this movie is that this magazine, The New Republic, was a big thing, you know, and the median age of the staff of like 13 people or whatever was 26 years old. So these were young journalists and idealistic. And, you know, they apparently they had kicked some ass and taken some names and had a reputation for being kind of snobby.
Not anymore.
No. Anyway, yeah, I guess we could dive into the plot. Well, so this is right where like digital journalism became a bigger thing. Like Forbes Digital, which is the people that Steve Zahn's character worked for, their story about this was a huge triumph for digital journalists.
Yeah, I mean, right around 2000, that's when kind of blogs and things really started to take off. But even back then, they weren't really considered legitimate.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, nothing delegitimizes the old guard, like, finding corruption or
the whole fabricating stories from old cloth.
Exactly. Ugh. Yeah, the worst. So we have the plot. It's 1998, and Stephen Glass, Hayden Christensen, who we know from Star Wars, is an associate editor at the New Republic. Among the youngest of the magazine staff, he enjoys popularity with his colleagues for his entertaining stories, and he serves under editor Michael Kelly, played by Hank Azaria from 1998's Godzilla, who the writers hold loyalty towards. Now, I am charmed by Hank Azaria.
He was good. Again, another, like, everybody except for Hayden Christensen is super understated in this movie.
Yeah.
Including Hank Azaria, who we know is capable of doing much bigger and broader things.
But yes, indeed.
He's just so chill in this movie.
Yeah.
And the only time he really gets to emote, he's doing it behind a closed door.
Yeah. And then we have, the writers love Hank Azaria because he's like a classic editor.
And he's very protective of them.
Yes.
Including protecting them from the main big boss, who is very scary, apparently.
Yes. Who is the publisher, Marty Perez. Parrots. Perez ends up firing Kelly and then promoting reporter Charles Chuck Lane, Peter Sarsgaard, who we know from Robot and Frank. And this, by the way, displeases all the staff people because everything that actually Steven is, personality-wise, Chuck is not.
They do a very good job setting up, before he becomes editor, setting up how inadequate Steven makes him feel, yes. Chuck feel. Because Chuck, again, is understated. He's not very charismatic. He's kind of just the facts. And Steven is all color.
Yes. Then also the reporters that we see who are, again, it's a small staff. And so they're very protective of one another. They're all young and friends and stuff. And the editors and the management are, of course, older people. But we have Chloe Sevigny's character, who's another reporter, and in this movie, Steven's girlfriend, although that was not the case in real life. And then Melanie Linsky, is that her name?
Yes.
Who plays the other reporter, who's actually just based on a real person, I think. And both of them, you know, it's funny. I had remembered Chloe Sevigny being a big deal because of the connection to David Plotz, but I didn't remember that her character doesn't get a lot of screen time. Like, Melanie Linsky's character gets way more screen time, and she's great. As it turns out, she's a really good actor.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let 2.5 Men fool you.
I mean, well, if you're going on ability, she was actually very good on that show.
She was. Yeah, even better, actually, when you have, what's his name? When Charlie was replaced by
Ashton Kutcher.
Ashton Kutcher, yeah. Who, I don't know.
She wasn't still on the show at that point, was she?
Oh, yeah. No, she actually had a bigger part of that show by that time, I think.
Yeah.
She was still floating around after that. Yeah.
No. Good for her. Cashing those checks.
I think I have mentioned before that I think that show gets a bad rap. It was very entertaining at points. It just went crazy off the rails, but I guess a lot of shows do.
It's a bag of just plain potato chips.
Yeah.
Like, it's satisfying in the moment, but then completely unmemorable.
Exactly. Yep. And all of the characters are detestable. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like Seinfeld, where you wouldn't want to be friends with any of these people. They're all kind of horrible people, but yes, they do funny things. Yeah. So this the whole conflict in this is that, you know, and you, the way it's presented actually is pretty clever, where he's going back to his high school and talking to like in front of his favorite journalism teacher's class of journalism students or whatever. And she's promoting, you know, like talking about how he's the most successful student, blah, blah, blah. And he's telling all these kids that, you know, here's how the real world journalism works. And so he's got this narration thing going.
Ah, yeah. And they're just both of them, both Glass and his teacher, they're just blowing smoke. They're both blowing smoke up his ass.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
From the very beginning, you just get that just creepy, crawly feeling on your skin where you either want to run away or you want to punch him in the face.
Exactly. Or both. The thing is, Steven has had a lot of success before the movie starts. He's written all these stories and he's had interest from other outlets. And pretty much everybody's a little jealous of Steven.
Mm-hmm.
And he is so self-deprecating to the point of also, yes, being, I mean, really annoying. Like, he tells these fabulous stories at the meetings and then says, well, I probably won't even, you know, I won't even do that. That's silly. Why would I, you know, whatever, you know, and then wants help with everything he does, you know, because he's not quite adequate enough to do it.
Yeah, but that's a total sociopathic move, right? That's getting people in on the grift without their consent.
Exactly. Yeah. I think one of the things I like about it is, so you get the sense that Chuck doesn't like him from the beginning. Well, everybody knows Chuck doesn't like him from the beginning because, yeah, Chuck feels, he says, you know, again, a very pointed exposition that when going around after listening to a story that Steven tells, where at one point he stands up on the desk, then they go to Chuck, who, you know, is going to talk about how, I forget, he's going to go to Haiti to report on a story.
Yeah, he never even gets out what the story is.
Yep. So, yeah, he can't follow that kind of stuff, which everybody else, you know, sees as well. Clearly, you're jealous of Steven. And Steven is such a fragile little bird and such a young guy that everybody wants to protect him from himself and stuff. And because he demands it. Again, his personality, like you said, this just the complete pathology of just getting people to do things for you and to feel for you in ways because you are so pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
It's masterful. If it's on purpose, that's the other thing. Like, I don't have any background in psychology, but it turns out, like a lot of things, I have opinions about it with no knowledge. Do sociopaths and psychopaths know what they're doing? If they don't know that it's wrong, I don't know.
Psychopaths for sure know what they're doing.
Okay, yeah, I suppose.
Yeah. I think I mentioned
they just don't feel guilty for it.
Yeah, I think I mentioned it before. I many years ago, I went to a training that had to do with communication in crises. And the guy that was teaching it was someone who companies would hire to help them with public relations through certain crises. Like, I forget what company he was talking about, but it was one of the ones that was affected by the E. coli.
Oh, like Jack in the
outbreak
Box.
In the 80s.
Yeah, probably Jack in the Box.
Yes,
because they are the example of what to do.
Yes, yeah, because when he was brought on board, the leadership of the company wanted to deny if they could or to point the blame, and he came in and said, No, you have to get out in front of it and be as transparent as you can in very uncertain terms, or in very certain terms, state clearly that this is the worst thing that's ever happened in your company so that people are going to know that you're taking it seriously. And one of the points he made was it's people's general nature to always move back towards the middle, or to try and balance you out. So if you try and underplay something, people are going to automatically assume there's more to the story. But if you come out and you say, you know, this is the worst thing ever, people are going to tell you to calm down and gain some perspective. Mm. So you kind of have to tailor your message to get the reaction you want from people. And if you want them to tell you that it's not that bad, then you kind of have to go in big. And that's what Steven does in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Is he acts really meek so that everybody will tell him how great and talented he is. And he asks for help so that they're in on it, and but also so that they can tell him, you know, this is good. You don't need any help.
Yeah. And then when he gets caught, he gets caught in a little thing. He says, you'll have my resignation if that's what you want.
Mm-hmm.
And because, yeah, you're right, because that engenders his boss, again, Michael Kelly, to be like, no, but he wants your resignation. Just calm down. Yeah. We'll get through
it. But as soon as he's pushed a little bit, then you can see where he's a bit of a psychopath, because that's when he starts throwing other people under the bus.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, well, you know, this person reviewed it or this person checked it. So it's not just me.
Yeah. Again, I don't want to color too far outside the lines, but I think, you know, finding the hole, the flaw in fact-checking, where if at a certain point some of your fact-checking discovers that the only source is the reporter, so you have to rely on the reporter having ethics and having integrity.
Right.
And having integrity and having a sense of ethics turns out not to be a something that is, you know, like written in law. It's kind of a norm.
Used to be.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah.
That was another thing that struck me a little quaint about this movie is the emphasis on ethics and journalism.
Yeah.
I mean, now we have entire news broadcast dynasties with the sole purpose of not ever speaking the truth.
In court, they would tell you selectively that depending on what hour of the day you're watching or who's the host, it's not a news program. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But when you they put yourself
have,
forward.
They just have news in the title of their television channel.
Sure. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, the other thing about Steven is obviously fucking brilliant. I mean, to be able to tap dance this fast, you know, but he's also, I mean, he's trying to go to law school at the same time as he's doing this journalism thing. And that's not bullshit. I mean, he's taking law classes along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and his girlfriend, you know, is trying to kind of calm him down a little bit or slow him down a little bit because he doesn't have any time for any real things and he can't commit to that. So it becomes, you know, again, a thing. Yeah. So even when she says at their little party or whatever, the Monopoly party that he throws, where he alphabetizes the beer and remembers everybody's little, and that is to me, that's like evil. Like where you collect all these facts about your friends and then drop them in on them. Although again, that's a good skill to have. Got to have memory for that kind of stuff. But yeah, so he's, you know, he's writing for other magazines like Rolling Stone, and he's got a particular writing style. He investigates and he tells the very colorful stories that people want to read instead of the dry facts.
Yeah, the persona that he kind of creates is, he always seems to manage to get himself right in the middle of all these crazy situations.
Yes. Yes. And tell in very precise detail all these wild conversations. And, you know, again, when pressed about him, like, over-tasking himself, like, how can you be a successful journalist and be going to law school? You know, he blames his parents for being too pressuring him too much. And anyway. So he has written a story called Hack Heaven, which details a teenage hacker being hired by a large software firm he infiltrated and all the craziness about that. So the story reaches the Forbes Digital Tool, which is the site or whatever, where Adam Pennenberg, Steve Zahn, who we know from War for the Planet of the Apes. I forgot he's one of the apes. Out of Sight, That Thing You Do, and Crimson Tide. Like, how do you not like Steven Zahn? Or Steve Zahn, sorry. He's the best.
All-time performance in Out of Sight.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody in that movie. It's an all-timer.
Yeah, yeah. Why is that not like the movie of our generation?
It's one of them. That's yeah. For sure.
Yeah, basically, the Forbes digital editor was like, hey, Adam, why didn't you have this story? Like, why didn't you go to, this is your job. This is Forbes digital. Like, we talk about this shit.
Yeah, and I love this scene with Steve Zahn so much because it's just a little thing, but it tells you everything about his character so quickly as he starts to read it, and you can tell while he's reading it, he's trying to come up with a bullshit reason about why he didn't get it, and then as he's reading it, he realizes how wild it is, and then he just gives in and says, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. So he starts digging into it and finds out, oh, yeah, this story is full of holes. And then contacts the New Republic, which now, of course, is under the editor is Chuck, and where it used to be Michael. Everybody loved Michael. By the way, the reason why Michael was fired was political or in real life is pretty much partisan politics. The owner Marty or whatever said that he was a conservative, and he's like, you can't just keep writing all these liberal stories. So it finally came to a head at a certain point, and so he was sent packing, and Chuck got to fill those shoes, but with having no support of the staff. And also not being very charismatic like Michael was.
Yeah, Chuck doesn't do himself any favors by showing up with boxes as Michael is trying to say goodbye to everybody. Yeah, come on, Chuck.
Exactly. Yeah, well, and you wonder, it is a spectrum, right? Everybody's on the spectrum somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody, nobody in the staff is happy about Michael being fired. And so therefore, nobody's happy about Chuck being the boss. And so they're basically meeting in little clique groups sort of away from Chuck. I mean, you get the sense that he wasn't part of their clique anyway. So, right. Because he's got a wife and a baby at home. He doesn't have time for the shenanigans like playing Monopoly and having alphabetized beer. We have this, so when Forbes calls the New Republic, Steven expects, because everybody expects his editor just to completely shield him and completely protect him from any of this and back him 100%. And Chuck is like, well, hold on. it turns out this story does have a lot of holes in it. Like, let's find out. And all of Steven's normal bullshit, it doesn't serve him well because Chuck just keeps asking for more stuff because the Forest people, it turns out, have lots of stuff.
Yeah, because they're finding out as they start to research the details in a story that nothing exists. Yeah. They can't track down any details.
Yeah, and it's not that the names have been changed. There were no people that fit that name, that role.
Yeah, no, there's no juked electronics.
Exactly. I love that. Those are real details. Where he made up an electronics company and then in the middle of the night made up a website. And the main reason he got caught is about the shitty ass website, for sure, is that he forgot he didn't know enough to make the website available to the general internet and instead made it only to members of AOL.
The early internet is a weird place.
Yeah, yeah. So the more they dig, the more the story is bullshit. And Chuck is getting angry and angry. Steven's getting angry because Chuck's not backing him up. And, Chuck is getting angrier, but in a real slow boil. Like, that. This is why the performance is so good. You're right. It's so understated, but you feel like, oh, yeah, he just gets more and more filled. And by the end, he's, full of rage.
And he's so good, Peter Sarsgaard, because Chuck, I mean, from the very, very beginning, I mean, Chuck kind of sucks.
Yeah.
He's just there. He's kind of a bump on the log. He doesn't outwardly complain, but he just has a look on his face like he's complaining all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when he's moving into the new office and you expect him to kind of give a rallying speech to the troops now that he's the new man in charge, he just kind of looks at him and sighs and goes back into his office.
Closes the door.
Yep. But something about his performance and how internal he is, but you can still sense his growing unease and frustration. I think you are on his side so quickly.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's a real testament to his performance.
Well, and, you know, and Steven's character is all like loosey-goosey with the truth, obviously, as is the point, but is also like super flashy and emotional, and Chuck's character is not. He's the opposite of that. He is very measured. He's very deliberate, and pauses before doing anything.
Yeah, and the audience is ahead of the characters, I think, for most of this movie.
Yeah.
So, you know, you want Chuck to figure it out quickly, but he doesn't. He is actually a very supportive editor. He's not going to go out on a limb for Steven, but he's also going to assume that he's in the right until he's proven wrong.
Oh, yeah. Plus, getting a bunch of facts, getting some facts made up, or like bridging some facts with some bullshit in between to make the story more lively. That's the worst he thinks is going to is going on, right?
Right.
That he made up like some conversations he never really heard or that kind of stuff. It doesn't occur to anybody that none of it happened.
Right. That's kind of the how big the whopper is, right? At first, people are concerned that maybe Steven got tricked by a source. And then Chuck is starting to get concerned that maybe he was fast and loose with the details. Nobody ever considered that none of it happened, including the hacker conference.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody even considered that. It just didn't ever happen.
Yeah, the guys at Forbes are as surprised as anyone. I mean, they're happy to take the wind out of the sails of the New Republic. And actually, it's funny because I had forgotten that. Well, I'd forgotten that that Melanie Lynskey was in there, but I also forgot that Rosario Dawson was part of this movie.
Yeah, she was. I have to assume that she had some scenes on the cutting room floor.
Probably. But she actually was a character that I think was necessary because it shows that the Forbes digital newsroom or news facility or whatever had the same sort of like dog eat dog politics like that the other place did, that everybody's just trying to get ahead, get the good story.
Yeah. I mean, she got one good scene where she was trying to talk Steve Zahn's character into sharing his byline with her.
Yes. And he's again, it was a good scene. She's good in it. He's great in it.
Interestingly enough, she has recently been cast as a Star Wars character. And I know you're not a Star Wars guy, so this probably doesn't mean anything to you. But her Star Wars character was Anakin Skywalker's Jedi apprentice.
Ah, excellent. I had heard there was Star Wars news. I just never heard what the news was. Like a billion more Star Wars properties or something?
Yep.
Yeah.
Including her character is getting its own, I think, Mandalorian-style show on Disney Plus. Which is great, because it's probably one of the best characters in all of Star Wars.
Cool. Was she in the Clone Wars?
Yeah, the cartoon.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which, by the way, I've been told. Yeah, I've been told that the Clone Wars or whatever, the cartoons there, are the best of the Star Wars products.
They really are. They really are.
I'll have to jump in that bandwagon. You know, I want to be happy about that world. I just again, I don't have time. It feels like Dune, but let's put a pin in that because I do want to talk about Warner Brothers because I want to pick your brain a little bit because
you're making some people mad.
Yeah, everybody's mad, and yeah, it's
I'm not mad.
This is well, that's what I want to talk to you about. Okay, so let's talk. Let's finish the Shattered Glass story. So the rest of the movie is just basically the Steven trying to tap dance his way out of this. And nobody believing, like Steven's friends, not believing that he's the bad guy because it's much easier to believe that Chuck's the bad guy.
Right.
And they everybody admits that he did something wrong. Just again, nobody knows the extent of it at this point. And again, even like Chloe Sevigny's character is like, you're just being a dick, Chuck, you know. Like, this poor guy, he's just a kid. Like, how could you ruin him or whatever? Because even toward the end of the movie where this whole, they're just talking about this one story, right? This one story turns out to be not just slightly wrong, but really super wrong. They're not even talking about firing him because that would destroy his career. They're just going to suspend him. Like, suspend him for 2 years, which is like, hold on. That's a quaint
notion. I didn't catch that part. Well, they're going to suspend him for 2 years?
Yeah, that's what the Chloe Sevigny character sends in an email, very quaint older style email to Michael Kelly. Is like, Chuck's not going to fire Steven, he's going to suspend him for 2 years, blah blah blah.
I missed that. That's getting fired.
Well, exactly. Yeah, that's like why? Like that was the part that I couldn't understand. It's like maybe it's different in those worlds. And again, I, you know, knock on wood, I've never been fired from anything. But you know,
I
mean, what?
I guess that would allow him to still freelance, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so you can't write for us, but we're not going to fire you so it goes on your permanent record or whatever. Like, isn't it not, unless they said why they fired him, I guess that would be scuttlebutt, right? Around the tiny community of journalists.
Right.
But still, I don't know. But yeah, what? Yeah, that's wild. To me, that's wild. It's like, yeah, Steven, pack your bags. Bye-bye. Like, that should have happened, you know, pretty much as soon as we figured out that, yeah, it was more than just one part of the story that was bullshit. But the movie takes you along a little bit. I mean, the scene where he goes and walks Steven through the hotel. I think the big climactic moment didn't take place in the atrium or whatever, but instead took place in the restaurant. But otherwise, it was completely like pretty much exactly what happened. Like, so you're telling me this happened here, and that was in the whole breakdown. Was like, it's like, yes, I'm telling you this happened here. I don't know what you want from me. It happened here. 1,000 people, Stephen. Yes, 1,000 people. I was here. 1,000 people were here. Well, you know, I just yes.
My favorite part was after Chuck finally loses his shit and just blows up at Steven and tells him to stop lying and tries to impress upon him how serious this is. The next scene is Steven has to drive them both back.
Yes. It's like, why would you let Steve drive?
Yeah.
Maybe Chuck didn't know how to drive. I don't know. Steve's car. Who knows?
Like, yeah. I was like, take a cab.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at that point, don't get in the car with a psychopath.
No. Yeah, because he's looking for a way out. Maybe that way out will be right into the front of a bus.
Mm-hmm.
When we get to the point that this is, I guess, just before they go down to the hotel, but Chuck calls the Forbes editor and says, you know, I know you have to print this, you know, and that's fine. Whatever, like, we fucked it up. That doesn't matter there, but, you know, just don't kill this kid, you know?
Yeah, heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking, because nobody knows how hard he's trying to protect Steven.
Exactly.
And they're all blaming him still, but...
Yeah.
He's very stoic about it throughout the whole process with his own team.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. And it... again, this part of the movie is it's just... I really enjoyed, again, it's a 90-minute movie. That's a great part of it. Mm-hmm. And it just moves along, great. And it's so well-structured because it just more and more piles up, and then Chuck starts looking at the other stories.
Oh, I love that scene when he finally kicks Steven out, fires him for good and kicks him out. And then, just sits down and pulls all the issues off the wall.
Yeah.
Starts thumbing through all of Steven's old stories. And you can just see his face falling as he realizes it's all bullshit.
Yeah. And there's a great scene where Steven, you know, who's this other thing is he's perpetually suicidal. Which I love the way this is dealt with at the end of the movie.
By Chuck?
Yes. But, so Steven goes to talk to Michael, who's surprised that Steven shows up huddled in the lobby of his building or whatever. And they have a editor to journalist, father, son, whatever conversation where, again, Hank Azaria underplays this so beautifully. He's just so charming. And he's like, so Steven. You ever pull this on me? And there's, you know, that's just leaves it there, which is pretty funny. Because, you know, when we find out, oh, yeah, all these stories, you know, were under him for the most part, or a ton of them. And then, we have this confrontation where Chuck and Steven, Chuck finally is done. And Steven's like, well, can you at least take me to the airport or whatever? I just don't feel safe right now. And Chuck's like, nope. Nope. Don't care. Yeah, I'll call you a cab. He doesn't even say go get counseling. He says, yeah, I'll call you a cab. You can wait for a ride, whatever the fuck you want.
If you need to sit down for a couple minutes and collect yourself, do it. Yeah. But I'm not going anywhere with you.
Exactly. And yeah, it's actually after the part where like the one part of the story, because they're trying to track down like these people in the story, and like the junk Microtronics guys or whatever, juked Micronics, and it's this Palo Alto, California number. And when Chuck finds out that he's got a brother, that Steven has a brother in Palo Alto, he's like, oh, fucking way. By the way, I did like the thing where Steve Zahn and Rosario Dawson call the phone number at the same time. That's just beautiful tradecraft there.
Yeah, it's so old school. And it's the GeoCities website that they're looking at.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we find out that they went through and they determined that 27 out of his 41 stories were either partially or completely fabricated. Which is wild.
That's brutal. That is brutal.
Mm-hmm. And then we find out what happened to some of these other people. Of course, Michael Kelly was killed covering the Iraq War. That's very sad. I think Adam teaches journalism. I think I found this out. It wasn't in the story, but Steven actually earned his JD from Georgetown. And he wrote a novel called The Fabulist where he got a $190,000 advance. And the book sold like less than 5,000 copies. So good for him, I suppose. By the way, he was offered a role in the movie. So was Chuck. Yeah, both of them declined. Chuck actually visited the set one day. And the day that he visited the set was the day that all the other characters were talking bad about Chuck. So that was kind of fun. But yeah, so... So Steven got his JD at Georgetown and then passed the New York State bar in 2000. But the bar examiners refused to certify him because of the moral fitness test and journalistic malpractice. Yeah, it's like you can't be a lawyer if you don't have ethics. And then more recently, and again, this is why it sort of came up naturally. Let's see. He applied in 2009. To join the Bar of California. And they also refused to certify him for the same reason, saying that you didn't satisfy the moral fitness test. And he, Glass said he had been reformed and petitioned the state bar court's hearing department. And it eventually went to California Supreme Court. Saying that basically the attorney said that his behavior had been irreproachable for more than 13 years, and it was proof that he was reformed. And they ruled unanimously against him, and they went point by point through his history, the standard of review and how he failed to satisfy any of the court standards.
Brutal.
Yeah. And yeah, so he is not allowed to practice law. I think he is some sort of like legal consultant. I'm sure he's making plenty of money doing what he does. This is a clever, clever guy. Mm-hmm. So it's wild. And of course, on one hand, and this is where the David Plotz thing came up in the political gab fest. I think it may have been, I'm sure he talked about one of the episodes. It wasn't somewhere else I heard it, but he was just talking about to Emily Bazelon and Don Dickerson about whether or not like to what level, like, can you ever redeem yourself after something like that? And pretty much the consensus from all of them, including again, David Plotz, who was this guy's theoretically his friend, or certainly his wife's friend. They're like, yeah, no, you know, you can't give this guy the keys to the car.
Right.
You cannot drive. So, shattered glass.
Well, I mean, to complete the bookends, they do go back Stephen finishing his talk with his class. And the last scene is finding out that he's actually talking to an empty class. It's the only one in there.
Yes, beautiful. So
a little bit of movie artistry thrown in right at the end in what is otherwise a pretty straightforward narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, again, and it works because it's the way you get the narrative structure of it, because he wouldn't be telling this story to a group of journalism students. Right.
Right.
Yeah, it's great. I'd forgotten that was how it ended. Like, it made total sense, but
yeah, but it was fascinating for them to kind of describe the fact checking procedure in the middle of the movie. Cause it's actually really scary. Like how easily he was able to manipulate the system.
Yeah. Again, when all this is based on trust, that's where people fail you. And yeah, it's funny because
the fundamental notion is that the reporter wouldn't lie.
Yeah.
Beyond that, it's just making sure that he didn't get their information wrong.
Correct. Like your sources can't sue you for taking them out of context or misrepresenting them. Of course, if there are no sources, they can't sue you.
It's brilliant.
Yeah. Well, that Jason Blair, right? Wasn't he a New York Times writer?
Yep.
And they fired him after the same sort of thing, although to a much lesser scale. I mean, he didn't survive as long as Stephen Glass did, as many stories.
Well, I would have hoped, like, fundamentally across journalism, that they would have reviewed their fact-checking practices.
You think? Yeah.
Tightened them up.
Yep.
I mean, I don't know, but...
Well, I don't know either. Yeah, that's the thing. Again, I've never been a journalist, but I have opinions. But yeah, I mean, and, you know, watching Jason Blair, too, it was the same sort of thing, although maybe a little more public. Because, you know, I think it was definitely more internet times, so he probably responded more directly to people. But, I mean, it went on and on. I mean, he was talking about, he did everything along the way about, you know, blaming sources and then blaming his bad record keeping. And at the end, he was talking about how, well, it was his job as a black man to burn the master's house down. Okay. All right. It's weird to try to, like, your last defense is, oh, I was a terrorist the entire time. All right. But, yeah.
If you go onto Wikipedia and look in the references for Stephen Glass, you can actually see an archived version of the Juked Micronics website that he created.
Is it laughable?
Yes. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
The email address is for the company is j_u_k_t@yahoo.com.
Ah, yes. Classy.
It's a wild screenshot from Netscape.
So, yeah, Shattered Glass. Thank you for recommending it. By the way, I assume that it was worth it.
Absolutely, yeah. This is a great movie. It's like you said, it's short. It's 90 minutes. It moves. All the performances are great. Cannot recommend this movie enough.
And for the listeners, it's even shorter than that because it's not available streaming anywhere. You need to rent this movie.
That's right.
So, yeah.
You can get the disc from Netflix.
Yes, you can. Yes, thank goodness. For how long, however long that's going to be around, we'll continue to get this from Netflix. Excellent. Thank you. On to housekeeping.
Yeah, I think we better.
Yeah. So, Warner Brothers decides its strategy for this COVID thing is to release its movies streaming at the same time it releases them in theaters. All of its whole 2021 catalog.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So what does this mean in real terms? I mean, are they really going to like hold Wonder Woman until 2021 or whatever?
No, I think Wonder Woman is getting released on Christmas.
Oh, okay. This year?
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Actually, is Wonder Woman part of the Warner Brothers thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
It is.
I know that, what's this guy's name? The French guy who's the director for Dune?
Denis Villeneuve?
Yeah. He is not happy.
Nope. Christopher Nolan.
Yeah,
he's not happy. He took some shots.
Yeah.
I think he had the funniest quote that he went to bed thinking he was working for the best movie studio and woke up and found out he was actually working for the worst streaming service.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Well.
It sucks. I mean, the whole situation is terrible for the industry, certainly for the creators, certainly for the consumers. As a consumer, it excites me to be able to see these movies safely sooner than I expected. But, you know, Villeneuve brought up a good point that, you know, it's probably short-term satisfaction at the expense of long-term art, right?
Yeah, I think his point was that, you know, he intended Dune to be the first part of a multi-episode story. And if you don't have box office for that first movie, you're not going to get greenlit for anything else.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. Does anybody really know what the movie industry is going to look like in 2 years?
Oh, no. And, you know, streaming services have been notoriously tight-lipped about actual streaming figures. Like, they don't have to release how many people watched Wonder Woman if it's available on a streaming service.
Right, because the metric is number of subscriptions.
Yeah. So if it's available to the whoever, like, Disney Plus is trying to become the biggest game in town and destroy Netflix, which, you know, they could.
It's just going to be different things.
Well, that's the thing is, like, you know, we've actually hit that point now that I think we were worried about where, like, you really do have to have, like, half a dozen subscription services to see everything that you want to see. Like, there's no one-stop shopping place like Netflix used to be or even, like, HBO or something, you know, where you get, like, HBO for a little bit or for, like, a tiny amount of money added on or Showtime added on to your cable package. Now we have all these subscription services that turns out it adds up into real money at a certain point.
I think HBO Max is actually pretty good.
What's included in HBO Max?
All the Warner Brothers stuff. They have a huge library of movies. They have tons of classic movies. They have a Turner Classic Movie channel.
Oh, okay.
In the service, they have all of the Studio Ghibli Japanese animated movies. They have all of the DC Universe, Warner Brothers stuff. And they have everything that appears on the HBO cable service, too. So they get, you know, relatively new movies rolling through all the time. And they're producing their own content as well. So you get all the prestige HBO shows.
Like the Sopranos and all that stuff from way back?
Yeah, it's all there.
Cool. Well, okay.
In fact, the past couple times I've been, since we're out in Willow, I have to go back like once a week just to collect packages and make sure the house is still standing. So the past couple months I've spent like one night a week alone back in Anchorage.
It's my dream.
it would be great, except I just have so much shit to do and so little time to do it.
Oh, yeah.
But so while I'm there, you know, it's the great thing is I have total autonomy over the TV, which mm-hmm. never actually happens. So I've been really wanting to watch like some meatier movies because I can watch them quietly and like on a real TV. And so I think I told you a couple weeks ago I watched All the President's Men.
Mm-hmm.
First time. And yeah. I watched it because I was just scrolling through HBO Max and it was on there. And the other week I did the same thing for Spy Game.
Oh,
I don't know if you've seen that or if you have.
Robert Redford.
You've seen it. Robert Redford and Brad Pitt.
I think I saw it in the theater, but I haven't seen it since then.
Yeah, I saw it when it first came on a video, and I was underwhelmed by it.
Yeah, me too.
But I watched it again. It is so good.
Oh, okay. We'll have to talk about it.
So good. I think the first time I saw it, I thought it was going to be a different kind of movie than it actually was.
Like a Jason Bourne sort of thing?
That's exactly what I was expecting.
Yeah.
Like Brad Pitt as a Jason Bourne character. It is not that at all. It's actually a Robert Redford movie.
Mm-hmm. And the kind of thinky spy movie, right?
Yeah.
I remember. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's so good. It's so clever. I've forgotten that it's a Tony Scott movie.
Ah.
And I was watching it and I was realizing, I think Tony Scott might be my second favorite filmmaker.
Hmm. After Denny.
Michael Mann.
Oh, Michael Mann. Okay.
What were you going to say?
It's like Vince Villeneuve, whatever that guy's name is from Dune.
Villeneuve.
Yeah.
He's good too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. What was the movie? Oh, have you seen the Trial of the Chicago 7?
No.
I don't want to oversell it, except that it's really good. I mean, I don't know if you listened to the podcast last week, but it's just because it's Aaron Sorkin, you know, like I said, everybody's too clever by half, but it makes it very entertaining.
I don't think I like Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, again, he's definitely doing a thing. So if you don't like that thing, it's not going to work for you.
I mean, I really like A Few Good Men. I never watched West Wing. Did he direct Molly's Game? I like Molly's Game.
I don't know. That I don't know.
That's a Netflix production, right?
Yes, it is. Yep.
The great thing about Netflix is they will fund a ton of movies or shows and give the creatives a lot of free rein to do whatever they want. Problem is they give their creatives a lot of free rein to do whatever they want.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I tried to watch the last Michael Bay movie, Six Underground.
Oh,
I got about 12 minutes into that. Like, nope.
Yeah.
So I worry about somebody like Aaron Sorkin just really having free rein.
Yeah. Well, maybe, like I said, you'll either like it or you won't like it. Like I said, I thought it was Jeremy Strong, whatever he plays, Jerry Rubin. Really, really good. And Sacha Baron Cohen does a good job, too. I mean, I don't want to like him, I don't think. But he's really good. And the guy who plays Tom Hayden's good, too, in the fact that I don't like him either. But that's not the actor's fault.
Which one was he?
He's Eddie Redmayne was Tom Hayden, Jane Fonda's husband. The more straight-laced of the protesters.
Okay.
But Frank Langella is great as a judge, and I forget who plays Kunstler, but he's really good too. Anyway, it's a good movie. I liked it. Yeah, I don't think, I'll have housekeeping next week if we get a dog. like I said, I don't know if it's going to happen. I mean, I think it's 90% going to happen. I think we would have to super fail the hello test for them not to give us this dog that we're buying from we're rescuing through a rescue agency. So it's not as expensive as buying a dog from a breeder, but it's certainly not, it's not going to the pound. But I think we will be a little more, I think we're going to reserve the right to be picky, which is good.
You definitely should.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a happy thing for me. Cause I'm like, yeah, if this dog's going to bark 24/7, that's cause I think they mentioned the other thing was like, the family has three kids and some cats and stuff. And so I think that was one of the reasons why they're happy to give up their dog, Foster. But, they keep saying, like, well, you know, he gets in trouble because he chases the cats, or he gets in trouble because the kids will annoy him or whatever. I'm like, as long as he doesn't get in trouble for barking 24/7 or chewing on electrical cords, I'll be happy. And so he's like, well, you need to ask those questions. I'm like, yeah, but I can't go in there being the bad cop. I'm not going to do that. So I'm already worried about going in there and, like, being, like, shamed out of wearing a mask or something. I don't know. We'll find that out. Because it's in Wasilla, right?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway. They will definitely look at you funny if you keep your mask on.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
You should.
I should.
I support you.
Oh, 100% I should, yeah. Although, you know, maybe we'll be getting a vaccine here in a couple weeks, depending on how things go. Yeah. Well, and who knows what's really going to happen, because, again, like all of 2020, maybe every, I don't know, man, fucking things are weird. Who knows what to believe? Thank God the Supreme Court tonight finally, hopefully, gave the final word on this fucking election. By saying that Texas thing is like, yeah, no.
There's no final word until...
Well, there won't be final word yet.
He is removed from the White House. I know. Probably not even after that.
Kicking it... No, he won't, for sure. And he's already raised $250 million that he can actually put in his own pocket when this is all over. Fighting this thing, which is amazing. And people are coming out of the woodwork. As much as I want to talk about it, it disappoints me to no end. That people are like, we'll win because we won by millions of votes once I throw away all. Like, what? Who? Why? How? What newsletter? What?
Get off Facebook, people.
It's not even Facebook. It's like OAN and what's the other news channel? Newsmax or something. And then Parler, which I think should be pronounced Parlay, like France, French, but maybe not. They wouldn't go for them for some French side of things.
There was an interesting story on that service that suggests it is actually funded by Russian operatives.
Yeah, why not? I mean, I fully believe that a shit ton of stuff on Facebook is completely foreign disinformation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, just like wrapped in a news shell. And I'm sure I've fallen for some of it, you know? But yeah, it's like he did it, man. He came in, he set the house on fire, and he's leaving. And he'll steal the fucking silverware on his way out. The best part is I don't know how much Saturday Night Live you watched lately.
Zero.
Yeah, you're not missing too much. But there was a funny joke about Melania as, you know, celebrating for Christmas. But yeah, she's the best part of this whole thing. Like, watching the trajectory of Melania is going to make me kind of happy, I think. Like, how long is it going to take until she divorces him?
She's in it.
Of course.
She's not going to divorce him.
I think they probably had a contract saying they couldn't get divorced until he was out of office. For real.
I don't think she would want to.
Okay. Well, maybe she's waiting until he slips on that final banana peel and meets his maker.
Look, she pulls her hand away all the time, but she's complicit.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah.
She's not a hostage.
No. Well, also, Mother Pence, I love her. Just the whole thing about on election night.
Apparently, after Donald Trump won the 2016 presidential election, Mike Pence leaned in to kiss his wife, who reportedly turned away and said, "You got what you wanted, Mike. Now leave me alone." Author of The Big Short and Moneyball, Michael Lewis wrote in an article for The Guardian that Karen Pence wouldn't even look at Trump. Also writing that America's next president just stared at the TV without saying anything, like a man with a pair of twos whose bluff has just been called. According to Lewis, Trump apparently didn't even have a transition team in place upon his election win. However, when former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie told him it was a legal requirement to have one, Trump grudgingly accepted. Trump later accused Christie and then campaign chief Steve Bannon of stealing his money when Christie had raised money to pay people. But he eventually calmed down after Bannon reminded him that if he didn't have a team, people would think he wasn't confident about winning.
I didn't hear that story.
I'm trying to think of other news.
So I've decided that I'm not in a big hurry, but I do want to get a PlayStation 5.
Cool.
Just so I can play the new Spider-Man game on like the highest quality. We bought a new TV for our living room, and I made sure that it was all compatible with the new specs. So it's got like HDMI 2 and the like the variable refresh rate. I have no idea what that means, but I read an article that's what you need if you're going to have a PS5.
Oh, so good. Yeah.
I'm going to be ready for all of that. You know, I just recently bought a game on my PS4. So emotionally, I have this need that I had to finish that game so that I could justify to myself buying the next console.
Mm, yes.
And that game was The Last of Us.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So you finally got through it?
Yep. I finished it. Probably one of the best games I've ever played. It was fantastic. It was a movie quality story. Like, I would have watched that movie. It was great.
So you're going to dive right into The Last of Us 2?
No. No. I'm not even going to go. I mean, one of the great thrills of finishing a game like that, where your character progresses in their skills, you know, by the end, they get better with their weapons and, you know, they heal more and faster and have, you know, a longer health bar. One of the fun things about a game like that is when you finish it, a lot of them have the feature, the New Game Plus feature, where you can go back and start a brand new game, but keep a lot of your stats. So you're not,
that's fun.
So like you start out like kind of souped up already.
Mm-hmm.
Very fun way to replay a game. I will not be replaying Last of Us ever.
Because of the emotional turmoil?
Yeah, that is a brutal, punishing game.
Yeah, wild. I mean, supposed to be entertaining?
I don't know. I don't know, man. It's not even the kind of thing I would recommend to anybody. Well, it's really good.
Okay, so I don't play video games lately. Since I had an Xbox 360, and then I had some. I think the most recent PC game I have available to me that I bought was Fallout New Vegas. So that tells you where I am technologically. Although I think my desktop upstairs will play those games. I just don't know, or more advanced games, but. Yeah, I'm just sort of out of the loop there. But, and I don't know. I hear about, you know, like there are games that you can just put on easy mode. And here, as one gets older, you just like, hey, why don't I just fucking play the game on easy mode? And then get through the story and enjoy the game without like tearing your hair out and having to spend like hundreds of hours learning things. And then I hear of games like, oh no, I've forgotten what it's called, but the one where you have a baby in your chest, and you're walking around the world, like a post-apocalyptic world, basically delivering underwear from one place to another.
Oh, that's the Mads Mikkelsen game, right?
Yes, it is. What is that game? Two words. Anyway, doesn't matter. They described it on How Did This Get Played, which is a podcast I like quite a bit, as being kind of like a walking simulator. Because, and it's not even like what you think of, like, you know, Skyrim or one of those games where you go out and like you pick lilacs for a whole long period of time. It's like you can't actually, you have to learn how to walk using the controls. And it's not super intuitive. Like, oh, this doesn't seem like fun at all. And yet, apparently, once you get into it, Dead Rising? Is that what's? No, something Rising.
Death Stranding.
Death Stranding. There we go. Yeah. And it's like somehow weirdly interactive and you build shit, but then shit falls apart and there's a time element to it. I don't know. A whole bunch of stuff with it. Supposed to be super satisfying. But yeah, I can't conceive of having that kind of time or wanting to play such a game.
It's made by this by the dude who did the Metal Gear Solid games.
They okay. So have you listened to the podcast? How did this get played?
Only the one about racism.
Oh, that was so tense. This last month, they did for November. I think they did like a Kojember or something where they did all the whatever his name is.
Hideo Kojima.
Yes. All of it. Well, not all of his games, but a lot of his games. And there was two different Metal Gear games in there that they were talking about. And I had, first of all, because I'd only seen you play Metal Gear Solid 2, I didn't even know what Metal Gear, what they were even talking about as far as Metal Gear, because I just saw some sort of like sniper guy like creeping into places and doing missions. I didn't realize that, oh, at some point you like climb into like some sort of Metal Gear, like what do they call it, mech suit or something?
Battle one.
Oh, maybe. Okay, I don't know. But yeah, that's the Metal Gear, that's the titular Metal Gear, or not?
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe the titles don't make any sense.
Yeah, I don't know.
And if you're trying to parse out like the a canonical plot.
It turns out I am not.
it's just a giant Ouroboros.
So I don't know. But apparently that's one weird guy.
I bet.
So yeah. So I recommend it. How does it get played?
So take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here.
Take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here.
One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you wanna catch an episode. They talk movies, they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the Brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open in that case. We got Eric, Drew, and Brother J. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way.
Hey. Not in a creepy way. 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 Okay. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. We got Eric, Drew, and Brother J. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way. Hey.